That's a little easier.
All right. So today is the 6th. We established that. To sort of look at the big picture for just a minute, I don't know how much you've listened to, but we're done with the will to believe, finally, after 7 weeks on it, which, you know, is worth it, I think. Don't you think? It's pretty interesting. I don't know if it changed Marty's opinions on anything, but it's very interesting. I think it's his best work. But anyway, we've moved on to his study of the varieties of religious experience, which is a very wide range. It's a series of lectures, like half of what we're covering, and it's very wide ranging. As a matter of fact, let me just once again read the various topics, the way I've divided it up anyway. So the first three lectures are on the nature of religion, which is what we talked about last week. We covered the first three lectures last week. We'll be done with James, I'm guessing, by the end of March, probably. Because we have this to go, and then a pluralistic universe.
Do you have another trick up your sleeve?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. And so the last, well, anyway, let me run through the topics. So the nature of religion is lectures 1 through 3. And then optimistic versus pessimistic religion, 4 through 8. And we'll talk about that today. And then conversion, 9 and 10. Saintliness, 11 through 15. Mystical versus rational religion, 16 through 18. We'll cover that today, too, I think. And then finally, the last two lectures, 19 and 20, I have labeled Neoplatonism because, and we got a little taste of this too. It was in The Will to Believe, wasn't it? Yeah. Mm-hmm. If you were to ask James, what do you really think, you know, about the divine? I mean, there's a lot of talk about religion, but what do you think? What are your religious beliefs? I think that it would come out looking very Neoplatonic. And we got, a taste of it last time, because remember it was the psychical research chapter in The Will to Believe, contrasting his position with a Hegelian position, which he regularly does. But anyway, at the end of this, we'll get more of a taste of the same thing. And then when we go to a pluralistic universe, we'll get even more of a taste of the same thing. So we'll sort of end the whole James thing with a survey of his own religious convictions, I guess you might say. So anyway, so what we talked about last time was just the introduction, the nature of religion. And I'll just recap that real briefly. His very first lecture is what you'd expect from a pragmatist. He's saying in the very first lecture, he makes a big contrast between the origin of something and its practical results. Well, guess what is more important for a pragmatist, right? It's the practical results. So he's saying, that's what we're really looking at. We're really going to view all these religious experiences in terms of what they amount to in practice. So that's kind of the announcement of lecture number one. And then lecture number two, we spent a fair amount of time talking about lecture number two. It's attempting to define what religion is. And he presents an initial definition, then he amends it twice. And the emendations are more generalizations than anything else. And, you know, religion comes off as looking at, in his hands anyway, as looking at something that you are just think of as if it were divine, something like that. Not necessarily a belief in a divinity per se, but a reverence towards something as if it were divine. Which, of course, then could accommodate something like Buddhism, I think, which is not necessarily a theistic religion. But then I got to questioning, well, does that mean then that, like, a committed communist or something, is that a religion then by this definition? Or, I didn't think about this last week, I don't think it came up, but Kant's idea, which I keep on claiming is the guiding idea behind the Methodist Church, even though they don't think that it is, but it is, the idea that that ethics is all there is to religion, really all there is, and that the kind of reverence that people have traditionally attached to God should be transferred to one's duty. Well, okay, then by this very broad definition, does that count as religion also? Because it does come off looking very broad, you know. Anything that one is sort of emotionally in awe of and has this kind of reverence for and views as though it were divine, even if it isn't, all that counts as religion for James. So, I mean, golly days, I mean, somebody who's really, you know, gung-ho on moral life can say, yes, I'm a religious person, even though I'm not a theist. So, anyway, that's the way it comes out.
That's probably not a rare thought, right?
Maybe.
I mean, for things that don't have a God but are organized around such principles?
Yeah,
That's not a radical idea.
No, I mean, as a matter of fact, the reason I mentioned communism is because I remember back before 1989, sometimes I would hear people say, well, yeah, it really qualifies as a religion. Of course, one would really have to be committed to it. But there were, certainly, and maybe still are, for all I know, committed communists. Well, heck, does that mean that Trumpism is a religion?
But, you know, you hear people talk about being
a cult.
They'll say they're spiritual but don't believe in God.
Right, exactly.
That's what I was thinking of.
Yes, I think that's...
That sort of vague spirituality.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's the... Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the way it comes out. In fact, let me just reread those things.
But you're not saying that Trumpism, they do not believe in God, are you?
No, but I am saying that by this very broad definition, which sounds to me like anything that one puts up here on a pedestal in regards with kind of awe. Do the Trumpists? I sometimes I wonder. You know, well, Marty says, you know, it's a cult. You know, but is his definition broad enough then to encompass cults? Might be. I mean, why not? Well, let me just reread it, because he states it, and then he qualifies it twice. Religion, blah, 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 shall mean for us the feelings, acts, and experiences of individual men in their solitude, so far as they apprehend themselves to stand in relation to whatever they... Hey, Reuben. Whatever, I'm obviously reviewing. Whatever they may consider the divine, right? That's his original definition. And then he says... when in our definition of religion we speak of the individual's relation to what he considers the divine, we must interpret the term divine very broadly, as denoting any object that is godlike, whether it be a concrete deity or not. And then, as if that's not enough, he comes back again and says, so I propose to narrow our definition, well, I don't think he's narrowing it, to narrow our definition once more by saying that the word divine is employed therein shall mean for us not merely the primal and enveloping and real, for that meaning, if taken without restriction, might well prove too broad. The divine shall mean for us only such a primal reality as the individual feels impelled to respond to solemnly and gravely, and neither by a curse nor a jest. Honestly, that does not, as I say, sound like a narrowing particularly to me, because now he's talking about the feeling. So in other words, first of all, he says divine. And then he says, well, what I mean by that is godlike. So then that excludes a god per se, and might be compatible, as I said, with Buddhism. And that's referring to the object of one's veneration. But in this third restatement of it, it sounds like it's an emotion. He's talking about the subject, not the object. In other words, what are the emotional characteristics of the religious person? And, you know, he says, the individual feels impelled to respond to solemnly and gravely, and neither by a curse nor a jest. So, in other words, one has... Well, remember, Jay mentioned last time Rudolf Otto is the idea of the holy, right? Mm-hmm. And I haven't read the book, but it sounds kind of like what he was saying, which also, once again, as I understand it, is talking about the characteristic of the subject rather than the object. If you're talking about this mysterium tremendum at whatever the other word was, you know, then that has to do with how I feel about it. Well, hi. We're talking about religion, huh? Strangely.
That's unusual for this class.
Right.
It also makes it sound like any obsession could answer.
Well, yeah.
One other question I had about the first thing, when he talks about religion depends on how it functions,
uh-huh.
not its origin, but how it actually works.
Right.
Does he mean how it works for the individual, as we're talking here, or how it works in the society in which it is propounded?
I think it's the former. I mean, once again, I think the key to understanding William James, remember how much I complained about the works on pragmatism itself and how vague it was, and you know, exactly what do you mean? You try to pin it down, and the next thing you know, he says, well, that's not what I mean. I mean this. And, oh, you mean this. No, that's not what I mean. I mean this sort of thing. Ugh. But anyway, the best commentary on it, the best commentary was number 3 of the 5 arguments, remember, for faith and the will to believe. The best commentary, bar none, right there. You know, in other words, what counts as criteria for evidence are not just perceiving and deductive reasoning, but also some sort of emotional something. And so when you say, what are the effects we're talking about, he would have to come back to that idea, and that would have to do with the individual, not with, you know, social
well-being. So it doesn't matter that a religion causes a society to function better or worse, or it makes the people in such a mm-hmm. such society happier mm-hmm. or
yeah.
more whatever. It's just how it makes
yeah, but
the
of course
individual.
That, but then the after effects of the society functioning, if that indeed makes people happier, then that does come back to the individual eventually. So, I mean, as an intermediate step, that might be legit. But the whole question is, how does it affect your emotional life? You know?
Well, you're saying that has he convinced me at all? What he's convinced me of is that anything is a religion at all in his book. That you can, you know, you can worship your dog, you can worship the statue of Pan that you have in your garden, and if it makes you feel good or somehow that there's something ethereal or about it,
I would say, I don't know if you know what I put in my notes, but I would say, no, I have to add this to my notes to make it clearer. I would say 2 conditions. I mean, I think you covered both of them, but it would have to be genuinely true, this statue of Pan in my garden. I mean, the 2 conditions are, number 1, that the object of my devotion be genuinely regarded as something godlike. So
but
it has
only
to be
by you.
Of course.
Not necessarily.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. We don't care about, I don't care about what you think. All I care is about what I think, right? So it has to be up on this pedestal here. And number 2, there has to be an emotional or a religious feeling toward it, I suppose I would say. This, you know, mysterium tremendum et fascina, whatever it is, fascinans. But, you know, there has to be this unique response on my part toward whatever it is. So if those 2 conditions are satisfied, then that would count as a religion. Yeah.
It makes one think, especially when you use the word cult, which fits in, or obsession,
yeah.
that a lot of, or some of the people who would, whose veneration of said object,
yes.
Would be defined as mentally disturbed. We would
those Methodists.
Okay, the person that's
They're all wacko.
No, we're not talking about Methodists. We're talking about you know what.
They really feel that way about their dog or their statue or mm-hmm, whatever. Mm-hmm. We would say.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
That they are. That they're not.
A little bit wacky.
Totally with it.
Yeah.
Well, except a solid atheist could think that you're crazy.
They might, but
I mean, right?
I'm trying to put James together and make any sense of him.
Yeah.
And since I'm, since he's his brother's brother, I've had a great deal to do with his brother. I wanted to think highly.
Sure.
But I think he's kind of full of it.
Well, you know, the fact of the matter is, I mean, this definition is rather broad, and that's my whole point, right? And you're right about your statue of Pan, but it would have to be a genuine reverence and not just something that I'm putting on, you know. Yes, Tom?
How about Louis XIV and the divine right of kings?
Yeah.
Right?
That's a little different, but go ahead.
You know, let's just use him as example. He's not saying he's God because the church was there.
Right.
But sort of plops himself in between. People are supposed to venerate the king, or I don't, what's the right word? You know, the almost treat him like a god, right?
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, the divine right of kings really has to do with the justification for the monarchy. And I guess you know you are supposed to be what's the right word? Obedient. I mean, that's not quite the right word, but not reverential toward your sovereign, but respectful, say, toward your sovereign. That's okay. I mean, the ancient Egyptian pharaohs, right? They thought of themselves as apparently as intermediary between the gods and the people and so forth. But they're still not gods. I suppose the object of your veneration has to have a kind of absoluteness to it, perhaps. And if you're going to be godlike, it's got to be absolutely the highest thing there is. Maybe then that would disqualify some of the Trumpians. Trump is just like a second tier deity as opposed to the only deity.
Because if you take like Mao wanted pictures of Mao everywhere.
Yeah.
So he was probably worse than Louis XIV, for example, because there was no God in Maoism.
Right, exactly. Yeah, there's nobody.
Right, so you're supposed to
have
pictures of him everywhere.
Yeah, I know.
Little red book quotations like
the
it's
Bible. Yep.
Mm-hmm. So maybe Maoism in our lifetime might be the closest.
I think that's a good analogy. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, Jay.
And getting back to the idea of mental disturbance, doesn't James address that in talking about pessimistic religion and conversion? People are mentally disturbed.
Yeah, we're going to get to that. But I'm not sure that all pessimistic religion is a result of mental disturbance for James, though.
Okay.
Al-Ghazali, for example, would qualify for that, but he's not mentally disturbed. Anything else? Okay. Well, as long as you're having that's a nice segue, because the next thing I wanted to talk about was the optimistic versus pessimistic religion, which is the next topic. And what did I say? It's chapter, I think, the lecture is, 4 through 8 even. I mean, covers quite a bit. And this is going to sound to us a little dated, I think. Let me just turn to the optimistic stuff. And he calls this something mindedness. I forget what exactly the phrase is, but well, let me just read it. And healthy minded religion. That's the title of the of the lecture. The religion of healthy mindedness. Okay, what is that? Let me read a section here. Let's see now. The experiences we have been studying during this hour, and a great many other kinds of religious experiences are like them, plainly show the universe to be a more many-sided affair than any sect, even the scientific sect, allows for. What in the end are all our verifications but experiences that agree more or less isolated systems of ideas, conceptual systems that our minds have framed. But why, in the name of common sense, need we assume that only one such system of ideas can be true? The obvious outcome of our total experience is that the world can be handled according to many systems of ideas, and is so handled by different men, and will each time give some characteristic kind of profit for which he cares to the handler, while at the same time some other kind of profit has to be omitted or postponed. Science gives to all of us telegraphy, electric lighting, and diagnosis, and succeeds in preventing and curing a certain amount of disease. Religion, in the shape of mind cure, finally we're getting to what we're talking about, healthy mindedness, mind cure, gives to some of us serenity. Once again, notice the emphasis on consequences here, pragmatic results. Serenity, moral poise, and happiness, and prevents certain forms of disease as well as science does, or even better in a certain class of persons. Evidently, then, the science and the religion are both of them genuine keys for unlocking the world's treasure house to him who can use either of them practically. Just as evidently, neither is exhaustive or exclusive of the other's simultaneous use. And why, after all, may not the world be so complex as to consist of many interpenetrating spheres of reality, which we can thus approach in alternation by using different conceptions and assuming different attitudes, just as mathematicians handle the same numerical and spatial facts by geometry, by analytical geometry, by algebra, by the calculus, or by quaternions. I don't know what that is.
It's an extension of complex numbers, so that I squared equals J squared equals K squared. You have I, J, and K, and the reals.
Okay. Thank you.
It's used very much in 3D animation.
Oh.
You need 4 degrees of freedom to be able to translate a 3D object and rotate it.
Ah. Well, okay. There you go. Okay. And each time come out right. So I'll reread that sentence. You know, just the mathematician might use geometry, analytical geometry. What was the other one? Algebra and quaternions, and each time come out right. In other words, they're mutually supportive, is the whole point here. On this view, religion and science, each verified by its own in its own way, from hour to hour, from life to life, would be co-eternal. What do you think he means by mind cure or healthy mindedness?
Someone who thinks like him.
No, not necessarily, I think. Although he's positive toward it, I will say that, much more positive than he is toward the pessimistic variety of religion.
Maybe he's trying to, as we were just talking about, to exclude mentally disturbed people.
Oh, uh-huh. I guess implicitly, I mean, by the word healthy, sort of suggests sanity.
I thought it was the well-formed mind has many things in its toolkit. Use them all.
Yeah, well, definitely, that's the message.
Don't go ruling them out.
Yeah. That's the message.
The healthy mind looks everywhere.
Well, the healthy mindedness, though, is the religious side of it. So he's comparing it to science.
It sounded like him, James the psychologist, coming through.
Oh, yeah, it definitely is. No question. Yeah. Yes, Jay.
Don't worry about evil. God will take care of
it. Well, maybe. There may be a bit of that, too. But what it reminds me of is Christian Science. I mean, I don't think the Christian Science has a very big footprint nowadays. I mean, yeah, I do know one person, well, I did, he's long gone now, I'm sure, who was a Christian Scientist. I mean, he's just brought up as a Christian Scientist. And I guess you still have the reading rooms around here and there, right? I mean, that's... Right. I mean, when he gets into this mind cure business, I mean, what is mind cure? I mean, he's talking about disease, right? Religion in the shape of mind cure gives to some of us serenity, moral poise, and happiness, and prevents certain forms of disease just as well as science does, and even better in certain classes of persons. He says. Now, I don't know. I think there's a bit of, like, as I said, I think to me this sounds very dated because. I don't know enough about the era in which, I mean, when did this come out? The early 20th century. I don't know, this has a date on it. The lectures, Sometime between 1902 and 1910. That's that's what the name of this volume is. 1901-1902 is what it says at Edinburgh. Basically around the turn of the 20th century, what was the religious world like at that time? And it may be that Christian Science and allied movements were more prominent.
I don't know if Theosophy is an allied movement to Christian Science.
Yeah, I don't either.
Active.
I don't either. But it sounds
theosophy,
to me...
Anthroposophy.
It sounds to me like that's... That was more prominent 120 years ago than it is now, and that's why this whole passage sounds very dated, in my judgment.
In some degree of that is popular now in the mind-body stuff.
You're right.
They're getting more and more interested in that, that your mental state can really affect your health.
Yeah, there are.
Yeah, it makes me think of, like, around that time, there was a lot of, like, medicine was very uncharted, and a lot of, I call, you know, basically quack cures and things like that, but, mm-hmm. you know, people believed in them, and even now we have prescriptions that are basically, you know, more for your mind than
the placebo effect.
Placebo effect.
Yeah.
It makes me think of that.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I imagine so. And that may have been prominent as well. But, you know, the Christian Science movement, I think, was maybe more of a formalization of the same thing. You know, you simply, it's mind over matter, right? That's the idea. You can, I don't know the details of Christian Science, but, you know, you can overcome disease without going to the doctor or anything just by willpower or positive thinking or whatever. And he seems to, and James is, I guess, partly alluding to the placebo effect and saying, yeah, in some people this works pretty well. And we pragmatists are interested in consequences, right? Not in what's behind it, but how it works. So if it works for you, then go for it.
Well, it seems to me, I haven't heard anything, maybe I missed it, about belief in the afterlife, mm-hmm. in heaven. Mm-hmm. That seems to me to be tremendously part of religion. And I think, I'm not a Christian Scientist. I did have one, a friend who was one when mm-hmm. I grew up. But I thought that they believed that they will pray to God and God will heal them.
Well, I think that's probably part of it. I agree, yes. And all I know about it is, you know, they would not go to a doctor. It was a matter of, well, just a matter of private, you know,
which led to some interesting court cases about the power of the state and medicine.
Oh, really? Yeah, okay, I guess so. Right. So anyway, James is all in favor of healthy-mindedness, obviously. I mean, this is coming off pretty positive in his assessment. But then, the very next, I mean, this was lectures, the chapters in the book, by the way, are combinations of lectures. This was actually lectures 4 and 5 all as a single chapter, and then but then lectures 6 and 7, and alluding to what Jay said a minute ago, the title of that is The Sick Soul, right? So he's not going to be too keen on the pessimistic form of religion. The healthy-mindedness is the way to go. If I had to choose between the two of them, I would choose healthy-mindedness over pessimism. And this is what he says here. Now, in contrast with such healthy-minded views as these, if we treat them as a way of deliberately minimizing evil, stands a radically opposite view, a way of maximizing evil, if you please, to call it, based on the persuasion that the evil aspects of our life are of its very essence. And then he goes on, theism, it has erected itself into a systematic philosophy of the universe, has shown a reluctance to let God be anything less than the all in all. In other words, philosophic theism has always shown a tendency to become pantheistic and monistic and to consider the world as one unit of absolute fact. And this has been at variance with popular or practical theism, which latter has been ever more or less, frankly, pluralistic, not to say polytheistic, and has shown itself perfectly well satisfied with a universe composed of many original principles, provided we be only allowed to believe that the divine principle remains supreme and that the others are subordinate. In this latter case, God is not necessarily responsible for the existence of evil. He would only be responsible if it were not finally overcome. This, of course, alludes back to, it was in Will to Believe. That's right, it was in the Will to Believe. God is the chess player. Remember that analogy where he says, just like a grandmaster, the grandmaster is going to win, right? Going to win. But the grandmaster doesn't know what somebody like me would do, right? But the grandmaster knows how to counter anything that somebody like me might do. So the ultimate outcome is fixed, even if the route to it might be open-ended. So you can have providence, in other words, that everything's going to be okay in the end, at the same time as free will and chance even. And that's what he's alluding to right here, of course. So in the latter case, God is not necessarily responsible for the existence of evil. He would only be responsible if it were not finally overcome. But on the monistic or pantheistic view, evil, like everything else, must have its foundation in God, and the difficulty is to see how this can possibly be the case if God is to be absolutely good. Of course, that is the classic problem of evil, and James thinks that he has a way around it, right? Because we basically, well, it's the way in which, I suppose, liberal Christians often think that God is not omnipotent, or possibly that God is... God could be omnipotent if God so chose, but God kind of backs off a bit and lets things play out. I think maybe that's James's view. God could actually get in there and control every single thing, but God doesn't want to do that. God backs off and acts as the grandmaster rather than somebody turning another person into a robot, see? Anyway, now the gospel of healthy-mindedness, as we have described it, casts its vote distinctly for a pluralistic view, as does William James. Whereas the monistic philosopher, i.e. somebody like Hegel, that's whom James has got in his mind. Every time you see the word monistic, you should think Hegel. That's the way James is thinking anyway. Or maybe Josiah Royce, I mean any of those Hegelians of the 19th century. Whereas the monistic philosopher finds himself more or less bound to say, oh yeah, as Hegel said, that everything actual is rational, and that evil, as an element dialectically required, must be penned in and kept and consecrated and have a function awarded to it in the final system of truth. In contrast to that, healthy-mindedness refuses to say anything of the sort. Evil, it says, is emphatically irrational, and not to be penned in or preserved or consecrated in any final system of truth. Now, I think, and I've contended, and that if you want a model of the God who is, well, what he's calling the monistic God. If you want a model of that, I wouldn't look to Hegel. I would look to Al-Ghazali. I mean, thank goodness I did that. I'm so glad I did the Jerusalem Letter last year. I don't even think I'd read it before I taught it last year. I've read a lot of Al-Ghazali, and I'd read about it, but I had not read it. And it is so clear on the absolute primacy of God's omnipotence. I mean, you know, the old classic question that Plato asks in the Euthyphro is, does God do what is good because it's good, or is what's good good because, or does God will what is good because it's good, or is it good because God wills it? In other words, which is primary? Is it the, is God here looking at the good there and then doing what is good because it is good, or is the good simply a matter of God's arbitrary will? And as Al-Ashari put it, and Al-Ashari was the founder of the Asharite school to which Al-Ghazali belonged, but as Al-Ashari put it in this very shocking statement, I always thought, if God had willed lying to be good, it would be good. Well, okay, that is saying that the buck stops at God's arbitrary will. Whatever God arbitrarily wills, that is good. Why? Because God said it's good. Not because it really is good, but it really is good because, in other words, the primacy is God's omnipotence. And of course, the Asharite school, to which Al-Ghazali was a member, had this idea that they had this, I've mentioned this several times, right? This atomistic view of the universe. There are atoms of space, atoms of time, and space is either occupied or not. It's either empty or not empty, right? And in each atom of time, God is recreating everything that fills each atom of space that gets filled. So that it's like a movie, right? In a movie, you're not really seeing something continuous. Your mind, you're fooled into thinking it's continuous. You're just seeing a sequence of discrete pictures. Well, that's the way the universe is. An instant of time is pretty darn short, right? God's really busy. So every single thing that happens then is a result of the recreation of the entire universe at every instant of time. Well, therefore, everything that happens is determined, right? And I have said that 1,000 times, that in Islam, even today, there's a lot of fatalism, and I think it's a echo, if nothing else, of the medieval view of God as controlling everything in the universe at every instant of time. I think that's a better model. I think Hegel is so vague and so forth. I think Al-Ghazali is quite clear. That's the thing I really like about the Jerusalem letter. I mean, it's absolutely clear. You know, he says, for example, you complain that God requires you to do something you can't possibly do. And then he says, who do you think you are to question what God of all things decides God wants? If God wants to require you to do something you can't do, okay, that's what God wants. End of argument. Who are you to complain to God of all things, right? He comes right out and baldly, doesn't beat around the bush one bit. You know, before Al-Ghazali, Augustine, I guess, was certain people's bete noire, or maybe Calvin, you know. But I tell you, Al-Ghazali out Calvin's even Calvin, who out Augustine. So there you go. I think that is the purest statement of the absolute primacy of God's arbitrary will and power, period. The buck stops there. Therefore, everything that we call evil is indeed due to God. Right? It's part of, golly days, if the universe is getting recreated every instant of time, evil's part of that too. But then God says, you're not supposed to call it evil. So once again, okay, why? It is. No, God says it's not, so therefore it's not, right? The buck stops there. That's the idea, but I think that's even a better paradigm, in other words, of this so-called monistic religion that James is talking about, than Hegel, whom he's actually thinking of when he says all this stuff. Right. So that's what you have to choose between. You have to choose between a religion of healthy-mindedness, which he thinks is connected with a pluralistic religion, which he will argue for in the next, at the end of this, and also in the next book we're going to cover. Versus this Al-Ghazali, Asharite type thing, there we are. Any comments, questions, objections?
I have a semantic point.
Okay, sure, sure, yeah.
So even in the case where God is the micromanager,
right,
even down to the atomic level perhaps, you can still say things are evil. right? Like you just said, well, it's not evil because God willed it. But the Quran, for example, is full of things saying,
yeah.
kill the infidels, and these things are evil, and...
Yes,
it's very prescriptive.
I guess maybe I shouldn't have put it quite the way I did. Yeah, you're right. After all, if God is down there at the micro level, even my saying that it's evil is something that's foreordained. Sure. The point is, God is not complicit in evil, even though it might seem to be an inevitable inference. God, we can't call God evil. That's what I'm saying. That's what I should have said, really.
So
right?
If I do something evil, that doesn't mean God is evil. I mean,
exactly.
if I go by and blow up your house today, that's evil.
Yeah. Or, you know, yes. I mean, but what I'm saying is somebody could say, well, golly, if God is micromanaging everything in every instant, every atom is blah, 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 right? How is God not complicit in evil? That's what William James would say, right? Yeah. And then a strict Al-Ghazalian would say, but God has told us that God is good, and we're not supposed to draw that inference. But it's so logical. So what? God has said God is not evil, so there must be something wrong with your logic, even if you can't imagine what could possibly be wrong with the logic that, you know, if God is doing everything and this is evil, that God's not complicit in it, but God, you know, because, well, yeah, there you go. Just like, it sounds completely illogical. As Kant would be turning over his grave, you know, Kant makes a big deal out of ought implies can, right? And can not as well. In other words, if there's an ought that is incumbent upon me, then it must be the case, it must be possible for me to either do it or not to do it. What sense does it make? Origen makes the same argument for free will. He says, well, golly days, in the Bible there's all sorts of commands. What sense do they make if it wasn't possible for us to either do it or not to do it? And so you'd say, how could God possibly command you to do something you can't do? Al-Ghazali says logic has to be subordinated to God's almighty sovereignty. I mean, I don't care what you think follows logically. That's irrelevant. If God says that God is good, God is good, even if you can't understand how that's the case. I mean, it's the most radical undermining, I guess I would say, of rational assessment or rational theology, even, you know. So I think it's an excellent, really excellent example, better than what.
Don't we say that if something bad happens, it's the devil? You know, the devil maybe do it as the easy thing, but isn't it the devil that, like Putin, for example?
Yeah.
Is he not the devil or influenced by the devil?
Well, I mean, that's certainly a way of getting God off the hook, but...
the non-omnipotent God, then.
Yeah, that's the... I mean, but then that's the case. I mean, I've heard sermons like this, too, by the way. You know, I think they cite, like, Job, for example, God bargaining with Satan, you know, what's going to happen to Job. Well, then that's the Jamesian move that God... backs off, right? I mean, here's Al-Ghazali over here, where God is really busy, to put it mildly. You know, right here, every single detail is instrumented by God, and then James is back here, and so God is now the grand master, right? So various things can happen on their own up there, even though God's got to pull it out at the end. Okay, so I mean that's of course another way of getting God off the hook, right? God has withdrawn from the micromanaging of the universe, even though God could micromanage if God so chose, but God has chosen not to do that, to give us free will, presumably because it's better overall, even if we can't understand how it's better. That would be a Jamesian and I think a rather popular among liberal Christians anyway resolution of the problem of evil. God allows there to be evil. God could prevent it every single time, but God allows there to be evil because in the, but of course this is a big picture, so that's always the, that's the ultimate, I mean, in the context of Christianity, the big picture solution is always the last resort. If you can't understand how this could possibly be good in this particular case, the answer is, well, but you got to look at the big picture. And when all things are considered, and if we can't, and of course we can't understand the big picture, but God can understand the big picture. So we have to have trust that God is managing things for the best, right? That's providence. That's what providence is. So, yeah, I mean, there's various ways of getting God off the hook, but all of them involve, I would say, God's backing off and allowing there to be mistakes out there because it's better overall. So, but God's not off the hook and out for Al-Ghazali. God's on the hook, but we can't draw the logical inference because God tells us not to. So there you go. Obviously, well, as you can tell just from the title of this, The Sick Soul, God doesn't think... God, James doesn't think much of the monistic version of religion. So, well, it's almost time to go. I thought I was going to get to, but that's okay. I did not get to, but next time we'll talk about the other contrast. This is between the healthy-mindedness and the sick soul, but basically between optimistic and pessimistic religion. The next one is about basically, well, the title is Mysticism and Philosophy. In other words, sort of an emotional religion versus a rational approach to religion. That dichotomy was broached in Lecture 3. I mean, that was the third, what we talked about with the third lecture, that there are kind of two kinds of religious people. There are those who are religious because it somehow satisfies their emotional needs, and then there are the more intellectual types, the theologians maybe or whatever, who believe because it's, I mean, of course, we're all a mixture of both. That's true too, but you could take more extreme versions of either one. Anyway, then next time we'll talk about that contrast, which is the second contrast between two types of religion. That's what we'll do next week. You yes?
Know, he lives a pretty good life. I can see why he's optimistic.
Yeah.
I mean, he's got a great life.
Oh, yeah, he does.
So, you know, it's like he never really talks about people whose lives are miserable.
Yeah, yeah.
So, like, what are they supposed to do with his message if their lives are miserable?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like, I don't know, because he's on top of the world, really.
Oh, definitely. I mean, most enviable.
Sure, what's not to like?
Yeah.
I mean, he's not that Pollyannish, but
no.
Still.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's easy for him to be optimistic.
I guess so. Yeah, good point.
Versus
in the current international climate,
in the mills, not that far away in the mills, you know, for
yeah.
example.
True. Okie doke. See you next week, Sue.
Okay.